All right. Well, let us get started. Turn to Zechariah. That is the subject of our study. I'm repeating a lot of the things I said this morning, but I mentioned then that my experience has been that most Christians today, and I'm talking evangelicals, well-taught Christians, don't have much knowledge of the Old Testament in general, and the book of Zechariah in particular. If I were to ask you, what's your favorite verse out of the book of Zechariah? Does any verse come to mind? I doubt it. It's a difficult book. Most scholars will tell you this is the most difficult of all of the Old Testament prophetic books, and I certainly agree. That's why I have put it off for years touching this, because of the difficulty of handling it, both for me and then getting it across to you. And so you'll see some of that tonight. You'll see some of the strangeness of this book. However, and most of the time in these studies, I basically use a study on you guys and then go to Mexico and bring the same thing. This time it's reversed. I gave this material in Mexico back in December and tried it out on them, and then now I'm bringing to you the study I brought there. And I was pleasantly pleased with the reception. I didn't know how this would go over because it is difficult, but I was very pleasantly pleased with the response and the reception that I had from people. And I asked them to read through the book of Zechariah, and the first day I was there, I asked them, how many of you have read Zechariah? And every hand in the room went up and said, now how many of you understand Zechariah? Not one hand went up. And I said, well, we're all in the same boat. It's a very, very difficult book. Zechariah has 14 chapters. I've broken that down into 12 lessons, which means that we have to take, at a minimum, a chapter a week, and two sessions, we're going to have to cover two chapters in order to stay to that. But that's how I broke it up. I suppose the world won't end if we have to extend. But I sure like that's about what I've got lined up for what it's going to take to cover this subject. Let us read the first chapter, and then we'll get started here. Follow as I read. Zechariah chapter 1, verse 1. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying, the Lord hath been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore say thou unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn unto me. And a better translation would be return unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. Be not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn now from your evil ways and from your evil doings, but they did not hear nor hearken unto me, saith the Lord. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? But my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants, the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? And they returned and said, as the Lord of hosts thought to do unto us, according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us. Upon the 4th and 20th day of the 11th month, notice that's 3 months later now, which is the month Shabbat, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying, I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse, and he stood among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom, and behind him there were red horses speckled. Some translate that sorrel or bay. It's a very difficult word to translate, and white. Then said I, O my Lord, what are these? And the angel who talked with me said unto me, I will show thee what these are. And the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom the Lord hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth. And they answered the angel of the Lord that stood among the myrtle trees and said, we have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. Then the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou hast had indignation these 70 years? The Lord answered the angel that talked with me with good words and comfortable words. So the angel that communed with me said unto me, Cry thou, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. And I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, I am returned to Jerusalem, and maybe a better translation there is I am returning. I am returning to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it, saith the Lord of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry yet, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, My cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and the Lord shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem. Then lifted up mine eyes, and saw, behold, 4 horns. And I said unto the angel who talked with me, What are these? And he answered me, These are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And the Lord showed me 4, and again, carpenters is how the King James translated it, artisans, craftsmen. Anybody have a different translation, a different word? That's different way it's translated. And verse 21, Then said I, What come these to do? And he spoke, saying, These are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his head. But these are come to fray them, and to cast out the horns of the heathen, which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah to scatter it. All right, there's the first chapter. Well, let's talk about our circumstance and our situation. Again, my experience is that most people don't have a sense of the flow of Old Testament history. They may know some stories like Jonah and the whale or Joshua and the Battle of Jericho, you know, but how these things relate to each other remains a mystery. And to really understand the Old Testament, you need to understand the storyline. There's a flow of Old Testament history. And to do that, you need to have some sense of what is the dates that we're talking about here. And an easy way for me, at least in my mind, to get a hold of the dates that we're talking about, I've sort of drawn up here. This is a timeline with the time of Christ's appearance up here at the far right end, or somewhere around 4 B.C. 2,000 years earlier, at the other end, is the time of Abraham. And of course, you would then have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob following him. If we split that in two and come to 1,000 B.C., this is the time of King David. Now, if we split the time between David and Abraham in half, we come to about 1,500 B.C., which is roughly the time of Moses. And then if we go the other direction, split that in half, 500 B.C. is roughly the time frame of the material that we are studying. Now, there's nothing, no major event right at 500 B.C., but you'll see in a minute that we're looking at events that happened about 100 years both sides of that. So from about 600 B.C. to about 400 B.C., that's the 200-year period of time that we'll be talking about in our study. Now, if you know this, and this is a fairly easy tool for you to remember. Remember Abraham, Moses, David, okay? If I were to say to you, okay, tell me about when did Joshua destroy the city of Jericho? Now, I'm not asking for an exact date, but look at this and tell me when that would have fallen. 1500. Well, Moses is 1500. Shortly after, which would be roughly, say, 1400 or 1450 B.C., would be when Joshua is there. If I asked you, give me a date for Solomon building the temple. 960. Rough. David is at 1,000. Solomon is his son. David reigned for 40 years. So somewhere around 950 B.C. Again, these aren't exact, but that's the idea, is that if you know this framework and you know, okay, Solomon is the son of David, then you know Solomon followed the time of David. So it gives you something to work off of. In our case, what I want to do is to zoom in to this time frame right around 500 B.C. So let me move to the next slide here. That is the same thing as more. Sorry about that. I mean, there we go. You may have to turn your head to the side to read the labels. But notice, okay, the dark area there in the middle, that's 500 B.C. And notice we have events that are important to us on both sides of that 500 B.C. date. Let's start over here at the left-end side. That's 606 B.C. is when the Babylonian, and I say the Babylonian captivity, that's not quite correct, but the Babylonian dominion over Israel began in 606 B.C. The nation of Judah, of course, Israel, the northern kingdom, has been carried off captive by the Assyrians in 721 B.C. Now, 120 years later or so, 115 years later, we have Babylon. They dominate. In other words, Judah becomes a puppet state of Babylon in 606 B.C. And there is a first deportation of people to Babylon from Judah. In that first deportation, it's the cream of the crop, of the best of the best, the brightest of the brightest, men like Daniel, young men, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, that's when they are taken to Babylon to be trained by the Babylonians in their astrology and all of their mathematics and all of that. Okay, so they took the brightest of the brightest, took them to Babylon. About 11 years later or so, I don't have the date up here, but another group of about, because Judah is not behaving as the Babylonians want them to behave, another group of about 10,000 Jews, and I call them Jews because this is the tribe of, this is the nation of Judah. And it's in this time frame that the term Jew starts to be used in referring to Israelites, okay? And about 10,000 Jews are taken captive again to Babylon, more or less held as hostages so that the nation will behave itself. And in that second deportation, there's men like Ezekiel. Ezekiel, if you read the prophecies of Ezekiel, you may not realize it, but all of his prophecies didn't take place in Israel. They took place in Babylon. So he was a prophet to this Babylonian refugees that had been taken captive by the Babylonians, and they're expecting to go back home. When, you know, they get tired of holding us, they're going to free us and let us go home. Well, instead, Judah kept misbehaving and rebelling against Babylon. And finally, in 586 B.C., they weren't going to go home because there was no home to go back to. The Babylonians utterly destroyed the nation, destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and especially destroyed the Temple of Solomon. On the 9th of Ab, the Jews still celebrate that today as a fast day, a day of mourning. The 9th of Ab, which is about our August, that is when they say the temple was burned by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. A fascinating tidbit of history is that in 70 A.D., when Titus and the Romans burned the temple, the second temple, it was on the 9th of Ab. I don't think that's a coincidence. Same day of the same month. Okay, so now anybody that is anybody is carried away captive into Babylon. Now, there's a few of the folks that aren't good for anything, and they leave them behind. Jeremiah is left behind, and that group eventually go to Egypt. But anybody who's anybody who can do anything, any of your workers, anybody's got any sense, they're carried away into Babylon. And that is truly the beginning of the Babylonian captivity, starting there with the destruction of the temple in 586 B.C. Now, a remarkable thing happens then about 536 B.C. or actually 538 B.C. is King Cyrus. What's happening is that Babylon was seemingly impregnable, undefeatable, sort of like Alabama. You know, they can't be beat. And it is the city of Babylon is this massive, massive thing. It walls, the ancient historians tell stories that everybody believes they're embellishing because it just couldn't be. I mean, you're talking about walls 30 stories tall. Walls wide at the top where six or seven chariots can race abreast around. And miles, 15 miles on a side. I mean, this is huge. It's just seemingly impregnable. And the Persian Empire under Cyrus, the Medes and the Persians attack Babylon, and this impregnable city falls in a night. And you may remember the story that the weak spot was the Euphrates River, which flowed through the city. And what the Persians did was divert the Euphrates, and they marched under the wall instead of going over the wall. And great Babylon fell in a night. You remember the story of Belshazzar's feast in the book of Daniel? They're having the big feast, and the hand appears writing on the wall, many, many, tekel, upharsin, and which meant basically turn out the lights, the party's over. And that night, Babylon fell to the Medes and the Persians. And so all of a sudden, there's this huge upheaval in the world situation. Babylon, which has dominated the world, has fallen to a new empire, the Persian Empire, under King Cyrus. And almost the first thing King Cyrus does is issue a decree that all of you folks who are captives can go home. And I don't know if you know how remarkable a providence that is, how many people groups in the history of the world have been captured by another people group and simply they disappear. Either they get assimilated into the culture that captured them, or they just work them to death. I was telling about the Yaqui Indians down in northern Mexico, which were, they could never subjugate these guys, so they just rounded them all up and sent them down to a place called Valle Nacional, which is down where Vega del Sol is. Some of you have been to Vega. And they made them slaves and they worked them to death. They just killed them. They're gone. They just disappeared. And that has happened countless, countless times in the history of the world. But here we have this remarkable instance where this huge group of people, these Jews carried away captive, suddenly are no longer captive. They're free to go home. And 70,000 of them, under the leadership of a man whose name is Zerubbabel, and he will be very important for our study. Zerubbabel, he is not a king. They're not free, you understand. They are going back home under the permission of the Persian Empire. So Zerubbabel is more the governor, but he is their ruler. He's the man who would be king if they had a king. In fact, if you look at the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew, you'll see that the line comes from Abraham, down through David, down through Solomon, down through all the kings of Judah. And then when the captivity takes place, about three more generations down, here's this guy's name, Zerubbabel, who is the guy who is in the line of the Davidic kings of Judah. So he's the guy who would be king if they had a king, but they don't have a king. But he's their civil ruler. Okay? Then notice, they come back and they start to work on the temple. They work about 2 years, and they lay the foundation of the temple, and then they stop. If you were involved in the Haggai study a year or so ago, that's what a lot of Haggai's ministry is directed towards, the fact that they have quit building the temple. And you say, well, why did they quit? Well, number one, they got discouraged. They built the foundation, and some of the older folks who were alive and remembered the first temple. Remember, that was 586. It's 536 now, 50 years later. And some of the old folks who can remember what Solomon's temple looks like now look at this foundation and say, man, this is going to be a shack compared to that. And so that's one reason for their discouragement, because they realized they didn't have the resources. Solomon was king of Israel during his heyday. And all the gold and silver and the brass that you read about that was put into the temple. These guys are a bunch of ragtag refugees that have come back You hear about the Syrian refugees. I had the opportunity of visiting when I was in Greece, a lady that worked with them, and hearing some of the stories. And these people arrive floating across the Mediterranean, landing on the shores of Greece with hardly more than the clothes on their back. That's the situation we're dealing with. Now, they did have some gold and silver that was given to them by some of their brethren back there in Babylon, sent back with them to use, but they don't have nearly the resources that Solomon has. So they get discouraged. And plus, after all, they got to live. So they started building their own houses. In fact, that's what Haggai takes them to task for, that you live in these nice homes, and God's still got a tent over here. You haven't built him a house. So what happens is that everything stops for about 16 years. Until God sends two prophets, Haggai and this guy, Zechariah, to stir up the Jews to get them to finish building the temple. Okay? So that's what's going on. That's the ministry of Haggai and Zechariah. You say, well, there's one more, isn't there? Malachi. Where's he fit in? If I can say, we know Haggai and Zechariah, their ministry is right about 520 B.C. We have the second year of the reign of Darius. Both of these prophecies here are dated to the second year of Darius, king of Persia. He started ruling in 522 B.C. The second year of his reign would be 520 B.C. They get the people in gear, and 4 years later, in 516 B.C., the temple is completed. Notice you have a 270 period, 70 year. Did you notice the 70 year reference here in verse 12? Look at the last phrase of verse 12. He's saying, how long are you going to not have mercy on Jerusalem, cities of Judah, against whom thou hast had indignation these 70 years? So that makes reference to this 70-year period we call the Babylonian captivity. But notice there's two 70-year periods. From 606, when they first came under the dominion of Babylon, to 536, when Cyrus frees them, that's 70 years. Or we could date another one from 586, when the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians, to 516 B.C., when the second temple is finally completed. So you've got really two 70-year time frames in this same history. You'll notice that much later, a man named Ezra returns. And if I were to ask you of important personages in the Old Testament, I don't think Ezra would even make your list. But if you look at the Old Testament history from a Jew's perspective, they put a tremendous amount of importance on the ministry of Ezra. It is during that time frame that the prophet Malachi prophesies, and I think I shared with you some time back that Malachi is a strange name for a prophet, because the word Malach in Hebrew means messenger. Malachi means my messenger. In other words, Malachi is not a name like Joe, Charlie, Zechariah. Malachi is a title. It's my messenger. And so there is a theory among the Jews that the actual man who's Malachi is in fact Ezra. That's the weight they place on Ezra. Ezra was a priest who came back to Jerusalem around 457 B.C., cleansed the priesthood, and according to the Jews, was the guy who first put together a canon of Old Testament scriptures, collected the scrolls and put them together into what we would call the Old Testament. So Ezra, extremely important. Then a few years later comes another man by the name of Nehemiah, 445 B.C., Nehemiah is known to us as the guy who came back and built what? The wall around Jerusalem. Now, what is remarkable is when you read Nehemiah, You read about him taking a reconnaissance mission one night on his horse, going around. He can barely make his way around Jerusalem because of all the rubble. Jerusalem is still lying in ruins in 445 B.C. In other words, there is no city there. They have rebuilt a temple, but there's no town. There's no city. In fact, you can read in Nehemiah how all the people are living out in the country. After all, they're farmers and herdsmen. They don't live in the big city. And when they finally get the wall built around Jerusalem, they take lots of the people to decide who has to move to Jerusalem. They have to have people that live there. We've got a wall around the city. We need some people in there now. So you, y'all get up and go into the city of Jerusalem. So the remarkable thing is we assume this stuff just happens overnight. You know, they came back out of captivity, boom, boom, built the temple, built the city of Jerusalem. No, 100 years later, almost, Jerusalem is still in ruins. There's no wall around it. There's no city there. So these things took a long, long time to develop. So what we know, much of what we know about the time frame that we're talking about comes from Ezra. And you say, well, wait a minute. Ezra was late to the party. He didn't show up to 447 B.C. We're talking about things, what, 70 years earlier almost, in 520 B.C. Let's go to the book of Ezra a minute. I want you to realize that the first six chapters of Ezra are not contemporary with Ezra's time frame. He is relating events that took place in the time frame we're talking about, 520 B.C. Ezra didn't come to 457 B.C., okay? So the first six chapters of Ezra is dedicated to bringing you up to speed, filling in the blanks of everything that's happened earlier than Ezra's arrival. Then starting in chapter 7 of Ezra, he starts at his time frame and goes forward. So, let's take a look. First of all, chapter 1, just quickly glance at Ezra chapter 1. Read verse 1. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, put it also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth. He hath charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? His God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel. He is the God which is in Jerusalem. There's the decree. 536 B.C., Cyrus issuing this decree, whoever you are from Judah, go back, build a temple to your God. Okay? A little later in Ezra, Ezra chapter 6, we have the story, first of all, of the building of the foundation of the temple. Oh, that's back here. The altar is set up in chapter 3, and then they lay the foundation in chapter 3, verse 8. You'll see the foundation is laid, and then they stop. They suspend work on the temple. But we read in Ezra chapter 6, verse 14, I'm breaking into the middle for time's sake. And the elders of the Jews built, and what they're building is the temple. The elders of the Jews built, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo, the two prophets that are connected with the rebuilding of the temple, 520 B.C., are named here by Ezra as being the instruments God used to stir up the people to get them to complete the temple. Okay? Everybody on the same page. You know all about that. I can give you a test at the end. You can rattle these dates off like that. Yeah. But you got the general flow. Any questions thus far? Yes, ma'am. Yes, you'll see, in fact, let me go to this next slide. We have the first kings of the Persian Empire. There are many others that follow this list, but these are the ones important to us. You'll notice Cyrus the Great reigns from 550 to 529 B.C. 536 B.C. is when he issues that decree. That's the return of these captives under Zerubbabel. 70,000 of them go back. He has a son, Cambyses, that follows him. Cyrus was killed in battle. Cambyses then reigned for 7 years. He was hated, disgusted, despised. However, he did conquer Egypt, brought Egypt under the dominion of Persia. But when he died, Darius, who is an usurper, in other words, he's not in the line of the dynasty of Cyrus, he seizes power, and he becomes the king of Persia. Now, some of you may be familiar with the story of Daniel, that there's a Darius back there. This is not the same one. This is another Darius, king of Persia. Then, it noticed in Darius' time, that's our time. That's the time frame of Zechariah. 520 B.C. is happening during the reign of Darius. His son Xerxes follows him. It is during his time that Esther, the story of Esther, takes place. And then after him, Artaxerxes, and that is the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. So that'll give you some rough time frame of the Persian Empire, the kings that are reigning. And notice again, just the expanse of time under which these events took place. Okay, any other? Let's go to Zechariah, since that's what we're supposed to be studying. We'll take a look here. Notice the structure of Zechariah is very interesting in that we have a little introduction or a preamble in the first six verses. Then we have a series of visions, eight or nine visions, depending on how you want to count them, that then go into chapter 6. And then there at the end of the chapter 6, there's another little historical incident that sort of stands like bookends. You have this little intro in the beginning. You have that event. We'll talk about it in chapter 6. And in between, you have these eight or nine, depending on how you count them, visions that Zechariah had in one evening. All took place one evening. Then in chapters 7 and 8, you have a visit of a delegation from Bethel to Jerusalem to inquire of the priests there questions about fasting. And we'll talk about that when the time comes. In chapters 9 to the end of the book, there are two burdens. And when the Bible talks about a burden, it's talking about a message that God has laid upon a prophet to deliver. So the last six chapters are two burdens, three chapters each, that deal with future events. So that's the layout. You have this intro, nine visions in one night, a little historic snippet at the end of that, then this visit of these guys asking questions about fasting, and then these two future prophecies at the tail end of the book. So that's roughly the structure of the book. Tonight we look at this first intro. Notice that it begins with God reminding them of how he was displeased with their fathers. That's putting it mildly. He utterly destroyed the city of Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, carried them all into captivity. He had warned them over and over again by former prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, those guys that lived up here around 606 B.C., back there at the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. So he warned them, and they didn't listen to him. And so he asked this, he tells them in verse 4, don't you be like your fathers. Learn from the mistakes of your fathers. He asked an interesting question in verse 5. He says, your fathers, where are they? Well, they're long gone. They're all dead. Then he asked another question, and the prophets, where are they? Men like Isaiah, Jeremiah. Well, they're gone. Do the prophets, he says, live forever? Then he has a contrast in verse 6. But my words and my statutes, which I commanded the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? The word here in Hebrew, to take hold of your fathers, literally means to overtake them. That my word overtook them. And the notion here, the thing that's being stressed, is that when we're dealing with humans, their words have power as long as they have power. But when they either have no more resources, or in the case of kings, when they are deposed or they die, then their words die with them. They have no power. But in this case, the men who first heard the words of God are dead. The prophets who uttered these words are dead. But did the word of the Lord die? Hardly. This word pursued them and overtook them, and every single thing that God said he would do to them came to pass just as he said. So the first thing that's to grab your attention is that your fathers did not heed the word of God. And look what happened to them. Now what's that telling you and me? You better listen. Because the word of God is not like the word of a mere man, even a powerful king. His word never dies. In fact, we have in the book of Hebrews the idea the word of the Lord is sharp and two-edged sword. It's quick. In the King James, what does it mean to say the word of the Lord is quick? It's living. It's alive. This thing, and the idea, it will chase you down. We're going to see that illustrated in one of these night visions of Zechariah here in a little bit. This word will pursue you and will chase you down. It'll enter into your house and seek you out. It's sort of like a pack of dogs going after the escaped convict from the prison. These things are going to chase you down and hunt you down, and they will eventually overtake you. So don't ignore the word of the Lord. And this is a pretty good way to start a prophecy, a book of prophecy. Get your attention right off the start. Look what happened to these guys that didn't listen. Well, you better listen, because same thing liable to happen to you that happened to them. Because God's word is not to be ignored. It is alive. It is powerful, because the one who uttered it never dies and is all powerful. And so that's how the book begins, with that little attention-grabbing snippet. Now we get into these nine visions. Notice the date is the 11th month of the second year of Darius. The first thing happened in the 8th month. So this is 3 months later. As I said, it all happens in one night. It appears that these are like a series of dreams that are given to Zechariah, because there are times, it seems, that Zechariah, between visions, falls back asleep, and the angel wakes him up to show him something else. Let me show you that in chapter 4, verse 1. It says, "The angel who talked with me came again and waked me as a man that is wakened out of his sleep." In other words, in between these visions, it's like Zechariah dozes off. The angel then rouses him to observe the next thing that is coming. Now, either Zechariah ate some really bad pizza the night before, or these are visions God has given him, strange visions. They are like dreams in the sense that the contents of these visions are so strange. I don't know about your dreams, but my dreams are weird. You know, you have things happening that don't make any later on. They seem to make perfect sense in the dream. And then, you know, you have people from different circumstances in the same place that never knew one another, no relationship, and suddenly they're in your dream together. What are they doing there? I don't know. Strange things happen in dreams. Well, this is a strange dream, to say the least. Let's look at this. It is a dream or a vision. In verse 8, he sees in the night a man. And we've got several personages here, including Zechariah. He's one of the actors. But then you have an angel that is called the angel of the Lord. You have another angel, the angel, he says, who talked with me. And then you have a man, in this case, a man who is riding on a red horse. And he stands among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom. And behind him there were red horses, again that speckled or bay or sorrel, and white. So he sees a rider on a red horse, followed by other riders on red horses and different colored horses. And if you ask me what are the significance of these colors, I honestly don't have a clue. Some have tried to link this with the four horsemen in the book of Revelation. You know, there was one on a white horse, one on a red horse, one on a black horse, one on a pale horse. But this doesn't seem to have that same correspondence. And they're not just four of them. There's a whole bunch of riders. And notice where they are. This is the significant part. They are down in a draw or a holler you'd say here in Tennessee and Mississippi, down in a bottom. And they are among myrtle trees. What do you know about myrtle trees? Yeah? That very fragrant. We have our crepe myrtles here, very similar, very fragrant tree, but very small. And in fact, the Hebrew word for myrtle is Hadassah, which you, some of you scholars will maybe remember was the name of Esther. That was her name in Hebrew, Hadassah. And so she was named Myrtle. You know anybody named Myrtle? Well, that's where they get their name. Okay? Now, what's the significance of that? When you look in the Old Testament, especially in the prophetic books, you see certain things being used as symbols. And one of the symbols of a great kingdom or a empire is a mountain. I'm thinking about the prophecy in Isaiah that in the last days the mountain of the Lord's house shall be exalted above all the other mountains. What's that saying? Well, God's kingdom is going to be exalted above all the other kingdoms. In Daniel's prophecy, we have the vision he has of a stone smitten out without hands that begins to grow and becomes a great mountain that fills all the earth. Again, we have a prophetic description of the kingdom of Christ, the universal nature of Christ's kingdom. So the idea of a mountain is a figure of a powerful kingdom. At one time, Israel would have been described as a mountain. But now, it's the very opposite. This is the bottom. This is the draw. This is the valley. Trees sometimes are used to illustrate strength of a nation. I'm thinking Gideon, his son, Abimelech, tried to seize power, kills all his other sons except one, and that one son went up on the mountain and told this parable about trees, and again, using big trees, fir trees. We would say here in the South, oak trees, you know, big sturdy trees. But in this case, what is being seen is not the big fir trees, cedar trees, it's myrtle trees. Fragrant, but small, diminutive. And so it would appear that what we have is a vision of Israel in its humiliated state. It is not a great kingdom. It is not, it's not even an independent nation. Judah is subjugated to Babylonians, Persians. It's only existing by the permission of Persians. Its governor is appointed by Persians. So it's hardly a great mountain anymore. But in the midst of this, we have these riders on horseback. And let's go a little further here if we can figure out who and what these things are. So, by the way, it's a good thing you're asking that. Y'all ask such wonderful questions. Verse 9. Then said I, O my Lord, what are these? Okay, I see the riders on the horses. What in the world are these? And the angel who talked with me, remember that's one of the angels, the angels who talked with me, said unto me, I will show thee what these are. And the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom the Lord hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth. And they answered the angel of the Lord that stood among the myrtle tree and said, we have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. Notice the personages. There is the man that is being addressed, riding on the red horse. There is the angel that is talking to Zechariah, sort of his liaison. And then there is another angel in verse 11, the angel of the Lord, that these riders are reporting to. And so notice they are giving a report that they have been roaming, cruising through all the earth, roaming to and fro. They are now coming back to give a report to the angel of the Lord that the earth is at peace and is at rest. Now, I think in many of these cases, these prophecies might have made more sense to the people to whom they were first delivered than they do to us. Because we are so far removed from these symbols and these, you know, we see somebody out riding on a horse today. Unless you're out west, they're probably not working. They're just out there playing. You know, they're out there having a joyride on a horse. in this day, if we think about the significance of what's being described here, is that what we don't often remember is that until about 150 years ago, the fastest that a man could go is how fast a horse can take him. Unless he falls off a cliff, he can go faster for a little while. But if he wants to go fast and live, a horse is it. And so oftentimes when you have large armies moving across the face of the earth, they move slow. They're moving material, wagons, all this stuff. You have these scouting parties that go out and they are scouting the terrain, looking for where the enemy is, where the encampments are, and that kind of thing. They're your scouting. They're your eyes. I gave the illustration of Jeb Stuart with Robert E. Lee, who Robert E. Lee said was his eyes and his ears. Jeb Stuart was commander of his cavalry. You get the idea that these guys are fast moving. They're light. They're able to go very, very quickly. I was reading, you want a fascinating story. Of course, the Mormons make a lot of hay out of this, but on YouTube, look up a YouTube video called Sweetwater Rescue. And it's the story of a handcart company of Mormons that got trapped up on South Pass in 1856 in a huge blizzard in October and could not go. And you had two companies of these things, about 1,000 people in both companies together. And out of the 1,000 people, roughly a quarter of them froze to death. And around 250 people froze to death before they could get them to safety. And when they realized in Salt Lake that they had two other parties out there on the plains trying to make it in, they sent a rescue party out of Salt Lake to try to rescue these people. And they made it over to Fort Bridger, near where we used to live in Evanston. They weren't there. They kept going. They kept thinking they're just over the next hill, and they kept going east, and they weren't there. They finally got to South Pass, which is where you come over the Continental Divide, and they weren't even there. And so they said, it's just too slow for us to take, you know, they're carrying provisions, wagons full of supplies and stuff to help these people. And they finally said, well, you know, we've got to send riders out, because it's going to take too long for us to travel with wagons. So they sent the scouts ahead, and eventually the scouts stumble on these two parties of the handcart companies out there trapped in this blizzard, and then eventually the supplies reach them. But that's the idea. You want to get somewhere fast, you send a guy on a horse. And, you know, you don't pull a wagon, you send a guy on a horse. And so the idea is that these are the scouting parties of God who are reporting to the angel of the Lord what they've seen. They've been roaming, cruising. By the way, it appears to be an angelic party. You remember the story in Job when God says to Satan, where you been? What did he say? I've been roaming to and fro in the earth, up and down. He'd been cruising. He's roaming around. I said he's sort of like a highway patrolman. He's out there looking for the speeders, the violators. In the same way, these guys are the eyes of God, as Robert E. Lee called Jeb Stuart, his eyes and his ears. Now, you understand, this is an anthropomorphism. When anthropomorphism is a man-like way of describing God, it is like an earthly king who would have a scouting party who goes out to be his eyes and ears, to make reconnaissance of the whole earth, and then come back and report to him, what have you found? Notice the report. All is quiet. All is at rest. Now, why would that be significant? Because they have just come through this convulsion. The world, as they have known it, has been turned upside down. Babylon was the power, the dominant power on the face of the earth, this world empire that nobody thought could be defeated. And lo and behold, here comes Cyrus and the Medes and the Persians, and quickly conquer Babylon, and a new empire is set up. And Babylon, who had been their captors, is replaced now by a kingdom that says, you're free to go home. So in other words, you've had this huge earthquake. But now the writers are reporting everything is quiet and is at peace. So in other words, this situation of Persia reigning There is a stable time of history that is upon you, is the report. Now, at the very least, let's put ourselves in their shoes. What does this tell you about God? Is that nothing escapes His scrutiny. And the omniscience of God, we call it, that God knows everything, is illustrated in many ways in Scripture. One of which is seen here in these riders going out on these scouting parties on a reconnaissance mission. A little later in the book of Zechariah, we will see a reference to seven eyes. We see that figure used in the book of Revelation. These are the seven eyes of God that roam throughout all the earth. Does that mean God has eyes like we have? He just has seven instead of two? What is the sense of that? Seven being complete, the perfect number. In other words, the eyes of God that nothing escapes His scrutiny. He sees. He sees. He knows. And that's what is being illustrated here in this first vision. That no matter what has come upon you, Judah, your God knows. And so, the lesson then that is drawn from that in the next few verses, in verse 12, the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts. Now notice we had the angel that talked with Zechariah. Then we have the angel of the Lord to whom the man on the horse is given the report. And it is now the angel of the Lord. There are those who say this is an appearance of the second person of the Trinity, Christ in the Old Testament. Others say this is Michael. Michael, the name means who is like the Lord. In other words, the angel of the Lord. I honestly waver back and forth on this whole thing. But let's just take it at face value that this is the angel of the Lord, the angel that represents God. But here the angel of the Lord is having a discussion with God. Okay? A discussion with the Lord of hosts. The angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah? How long are you going to keep this up? He says, you've had indignation against them these 70 years. 70 years you've been angry with your people. And then the Lord answers back in verse 13. He answered the angel that talked with me with good words and comfortable words. And that, again, might not mean much to us, except if you knew the prophecy of Isaiah starting in chapter 40, when you have comfort ye my people. In other words, that God is going to overthrow your captivity. He's going to speak comfortable words to you. So that's the significance here, is that your captivity is over. God's going to comfort you. And so the angel that spoke with me said unto me, cry thou. Notice now the angel that's talking to Zechariah says to Zechariah, I want you to proclaim, I want you to speak, cry out, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem, for Zion, with a great jealousy, and I am very sore displeased with the Gentiles, or the heathen that are at ease. For I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. In other words, I used them to chastise my people, but they didn't stop. I was a little displeased with my people. It's like I wanted them to give them three licks, they gave them six, or whatever. They went overboard. And so now my anger is going to be directed at those who were their oppressors, the Babylonians. I'm going to judge them. I'm going to comfort Judah. Previously, it's the other way around. Judah was the one being oppressed. But now I'm angry with them. I'm going to comfort you. And verse 16, thus saith the Lord, I am returned, or as I think a better translation, I am returning. I'm coming back to Jerusalem with mercies. I'm under the strong impression that these guys had the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, that they were familiar with these previous prophets. We know the reference here to the 70 years that God's displeased with Judah. It was Jeremiah who first brought that up, that God would judge them for 70 years. In fact, Daniel tells us he was reading the prophet Jeremiah and understood that 70 years was the length of the captivity. Well, guess what? Let me go back to my timeline here. if Daniel was taken captive in 606 B.C., that's when he was shipped off to Babylon, and he's reading Jeremiah saying the captivity is going to last 70 years, and he is now an old, old man, just prior to 536 B.C., what he realizes is 70 years about up. That's about how long I've been here. But notice, Daniel had access to Jeremiah's prophecy. I am under the assumption that these guys had access to those earlier prophets, or it wouldn't have made sense for God to say, remember what the earlier prophets said to your fathers? Don't do like them, don't ignore them, if they didn't have access to those prophecies. You see my reasoning? Now you say, well, why is that important here? Because in the prophecies of Ezekiel, God leaves Jerusalem. He has this vision of the temple. Now remember, Ezekiel's not in Jerusalem, he's in Babylon. But he has a vision of what's going on in Jerusalem. And what he sees is the glory of the Lord. He said first it moved from between the cherubim up over the Ark of the Covenant, which is where the glory of God rested. It moved from there to the threshold of the temple, to the door. And then a few chapters later, it moves from the door of the temple to the mountain on the east side of Jerusalem. Mountain on the east side of Jerusalem is the Mount of Olives. And then he sees the glory of the Lord depart from the Mount of Olives. So progressively, God is leaving his people. You get the prophecy? So now, God is saying, I am returning to Jerusalem. My glory that departed is going to come back. In fact, you who are around for the Haggai study may remember that one of his prophecies is that don't despise this temple, because my glory is going to come back to this temple in a greater way than it ever had come to Solomon's temple. And you say, well, how could that be? Because the glory of God, the person of Christ, is going to come to that temple. So you see the significance of God saying, I'm coming back to you. But notice this coming back and this coming back to me. It's strange, isn't it? That first section, return to me. And if I'm in Jerusalem, I'm not in Jerusalem, I'm in Judah. I'm one of the refugees that came back. I said, why are you telling that to me? Tell that to those guys back there in Babylon that never came back. I came back. I returned. We get a hint that returning to God means more than taking a physical journey. It's more than being in a geographical spot. It has to do with the condition of the heart. That's how you return to God. These are the returners who are being urged by God, return. Return to me. And now God is saying, I am going to return to my people. But he's going to come back in a very different way, as we will see as we progress here. So there's the prophecy that God's going to return. In verse 16, the middle part, my house will be built. And by the way, if you believe in predestination, you'd say, well, if he declares that his house is going to be built, we don't have to build it. We just sit around and watch it. You know. But notice, the fact of certainty does not rule out the fact of necessity. The fact that an event is certain does not mean it's not necessary. And so the fact that God has determined his house is going to be built, somebody's got to build it. Get the picture? So here we see that. Thirdly, he says a line, not lion, but a line. A line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. That will be the subject next week in chapter 2. The line being stretched. Okay? So leave that to then. So in other words, what this is saying is God is going to rebuild the city, rebuild the temple, repopulate the land. All right, quickly, these last two visions, which again are very strange. He looks up and he sees in verse 18 four horns. And he asks the question that we all want to know. What are these? And he answers, these are the horns that have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. Now, I gave you a while ago, sometimes a mountain is indicative, a symbol of a great power, sometimes a great big tree. But in the Old Testament prophets, another picture of a powerful ruler usually is a horn. I mean, that's the business end of an animal, right? That's what he's going to do damage with to you with, is the horn. Are you familiar with Daniel's prophecies? Where you have the goat and the he-goat and the ram and their clashing horns, and the horn, one horn comes up first. The he-goat has a horn comes up first, and then a second horn comes up second and over the top of the first horn. Y'all don't have a clue what I'm talking about. Okay, a few of you are familiar with that. In other words, in the case of the he-goat, this is Persia he's talking about. How at first it was the Medes who were the first horn, and then later it was the Persians who were the greater horn. But notice the horn indicates power. And we have that here very clearly explained. These are the powers, these are the horns that have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. Now again, in Daniel's prophecy, we have two series of four sequences. Is that a good way of putting it? Four things in sequence. What are they? Steve, I know you know this.
The statue.
We have a figure of a man. You remember? Okay, what's the four things? I got you now.
Gold
head.
The iron.
Okay. You got the idea. You have a gold head, silver chest, bronze midsection, legs of iron, feet iron mixed with clay. In other words, you have these four materials that are explained there, that these are four kingdoms, four, Babylon being the head of gold, again, Persia being the chest of silver, Greece being the midsection of brass, and then this bad kingdom, Rome, would be the next one. Okay, that's the first series. What's the second one? Four beasts. Okay, name the beast.
First one is bear.
That's the second one. Lion. Lion is first. Babylon. The bear is Persia.
Leopard
is Greece. And then again, just the big bad wolf, or this monster, that's Rome. So in other words, in two different places in Daniel, you have these sequences of four kingdoms, four successive kingdoms. I would assume that's what's being illustrated here when we have the four horns. Now, there are others who take a different position. It says, after all, these are described as the kingdoms that have persecuted Judah. And, of course, that could be Philistines and Ammonite, you know, who knows. But in my mind, if they are, again, familiar with Daniel's prophecies, when you say four horns, their mind's going to go to that. This is reinforcing what Daniel said. And so what we're seeing is a succession. What's not indicated here is these four horns aren't all at one time. They're a sequence of four, as we see in Daniel's prophecy. And following on the heels of this vision, and when I said there's either eight or nine visions, it depends on whether you take this vision and the next one is two, or just two different parts of the same one. I'll take them as separate. But notice the last one is in verse 20 and 21, where now he sees coming up these four, again, craftsmen, carpenters, artisans, who come to scatter or to destroy the horns, to fray them, to terrify them. In other words, you have the four horns appearing, and then in the four carpenters, you have the instruments of the destruction of the four horns. If I think in carpenter terms, it's like you have the horn and then you have the carpenter with his saw come along and saw the horn off. Something like that. In other words, you have these craftsmen who are here to destroy the power of the horn. So in other words, what we see is very similar to Daniel's prophecy in that you have the rise of these huge empires on the earth. Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. But in the midst of it, each one of these horns only lasts so long that God is also raising up an instrument to destroy the horn. And the instrument to destroy the horn is the next horn. Each horn has something that's going to destroy it. And it is in each case. In other words, who destroyed Babylon? It's Persia. Who destroys Persia? Greece. Who destroys Greece? Rome. In other words, each kingdom is destroyed by the next kingdom. So you have these huge, seemingly to Judah, impregnable kingdoms. They're just, they're helpless in the face of these. And in the midst of this, God has given them a prophecy that no, that I am firmly in control of the situation. So in other words, this is the correspondence to the earlier picture of God knowing everything. That's what the horsemen are indicating. Now we have the picture that God is controlling everything. That it is He who is raising up empires, and it is He who is slapping them down when He's finished with them. The lesson is that the nations of this earth, no matter how powerful they are king for a day. Just for a while. The waves of the ocean is a figure that the Bible uses to describe the kingdoms of the earth. And that's an interesting figure. Because if you go down to the beach and you snap you a picture of the ocean, let's say you got a big storm out in the go, you take you a picture and then wait 5 seconds and take another picture. And you compare those two pictures. What do you see? What was up over here is now down. And what was down is now up. That is the tangible, the flux, the flow of world history. And so we tend to think, good old United States of America, we're strong militarily, economically, we can never fall. Well, that's what they thought about Babylon. That's what they thought about Persia. We're gonna talk in the later lessons of when Greece, under Alexander the Great, defeated the Persians. They couldn't believe it was happening. He had a force of about 40,000 Greeks and then 120,000 Persians. They couldn't believe it. How is this happening? Well, somebody's calling the shots behind the scenes. All right, y'all now are experts on the prophet Zechariah. Okay? I realize this is difficult for us to grasp, but notice this is laying the foundation. Fundamental things. God knows everything. God is in control of everything. These are comforting words because the God who knows everything and who is in control of everything has said, I am jealous for Judah. I am jealous for my people. I was mad at them for a little while, but I got over it. I'm now mad at their oppressors, and I am now for them. And if God be for you, who can be against you? So who is going to stop? I have determined that the temple will be built, Jerusalem will be established, the nation will be established once again. So here is the background, the fundamental thing. I know we realize, we say the sovereignty of God, and we believe that, but do we realize how fundamental that is to everything else we believe? That if that is not true, then everything else is up for grabs. But the fact that God is firmly in control of the events of life in general, and your life in particular, is where our comfort comes from. All right, before we go on, and again, I invite you to read ahead. May not do you much good, but no, get familiar with it. Just get familiar with what's coming, and we'll talk about it as we go. Any questions? Anything that's... And may I say that I am giving you my best guess. When we deal with prophets, prophecy... I think we're not dealing so much in dogmatics as probabilities. That certain interpretations are the most likely. Is it possible that it could be something else? Sure. These writers, for instance, down there in the bottom. Could it be something else? Sure. I think I've given you the most probable. I've read about half a dozen books on Zechariah, the latest and greatest. And come away saying, these guys don't know any better than I know. They're giving you their best guess. I've tried to take all of that and boil it down and basically say, okay, looking at all the evidence, it appears to me this is what's going on. So that's what I'm sharing with you. Is it possible I'm wrong? Sure. And especially when you're dealing with prophecy, it doesn't pay to be too dogmatic. But I think you see the flow here. And I realize right now you're asking, how does this apply to me? Well, as I've explained, it does apply to you. These general things are very important, whether you're living in their day or our day. Starting next week, we're going to see the significance of how, yes, this prophecy that was given in 520 B.C. affects what's happening to you and me today. Anyway, any questions? Yeah, Barry? Always count on Barry for a question.
So, say like from verses 12 to about 17, that's where we've got God saying He's going to raise up Jerusalem. He doesn't really use that exact phrase, but that's the way we take it. He's going to restore them to a powerful kingdom.
Well, yeah, He's going to raise them up again. Verse 16, I'm going to return to Jerusalem with mercy.
Yeah.
My house will be built. Judah will be repopulated.
Yeah.
Jerusalem.
Yeah. He's going to have mercy on Jerusalem. And in verse 17, He's going to comfort Zion and shall choose Jerusalem. All that kind of stuff. So now then there would be some that would take that to refer then to physical Israel.
Physical Israel.
In a future millennium, right?
Either they would be those. One school says this is simply talking about Jerusalem being rebuilt in Zechariah's day. Well, certainly it refers to that.
Yeah, but they weren't any powerful kingdoms.
No, they did not become the powerful dominion. Right. In other words, this is back to what is called, are you familiar with what's called the double fulfillment of prophecy? That you have a near and far, you have a near sort of partial fulfillment, then you have the real fulfillment down the road. This then would fall under that, Barry, that there is a sense in which it's partially fulfilled in the historical events. Because after all, they are going to build a temple. They are going to rebuild the city. The city is going to be rebuilt. The question is, does that empty the prophecy of its meaning? Is it just that? Next week, Barry, I think your question will be answered in that you'll see that no earthly city of Jerusalem can possibly fulfill what is about to be said about this city that God has determined to be built. So although you have it happening historically, it's sort of like this is the model, this is the replica of the real deal. But the real deal is something a whole lot bigger than that city over there in the Middle East. And we'll start seeing that next week, that the focus of Zechariah as the focus of all the prophetic books is ahead to the New Testament and to the kingdom of Christ. That's the thrust. We're just sort of laying the groundwork for that tonight. Other things pop up? Yeah.
So you're saying that the Jerusalem there, the prophecy that Barry talked about, that the future fulfillment would be the new Jerusalem, the New Testament church.
That's what I'm saying.
And does that then correlate with the second of the visions with the four horns, if that wasn't the fourth horn would be Rome, they finally destroyed the earth of Jerusalem, like completely wiped off face of the earth that had never been rebuilt.
The temple, yeah.
So to say, I don't know how much you can take this chronologically, but at least chronologically, in the order of the vision, there is God saying He is going to return to Jerusalem with mercy, my house will be built in it, there will overflow with prosperity, etc., etc. And then the four horns, these are the horns that have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. If the four horns are the same four countries, one of them has not yet at this point finished scattering Israel, Judah, and Jerusalem.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Really, two more, Greece and Rome, yeah. You've got two more to go. And what is significant? This is why I say Daniel's prophecy is significant, because Daniel makes it clear that in that the days of that fourth kingdom, God will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. Remember that prophecy back in Daniel. And so there is this sequence of kingdoms, and during that fourth one, God will set up a kingdom which will never disappear, will dominion over all the earth. And the question is, that certainly wasn't earthly Israel. Earthly Israel was basically put out of business. Now, there is the futurist camp of understanding prophecy, of saying, well, all of this was going to happen in the millennium. It's all future. But I think I can make a strong case next week that I hope will convince you that no, what Zechariah is seeing in these visions is actually a picture of this coming kingdom, the heavenly Jerusalem. He's using the earthly Jerusalem to illustrate it. The rebuilding that's going on, the rebuilding of the temple, the rebuilding of the city, is illustrating it, but the real fulfillment can't be explained by what happened there only. There's more to it than that. And the only thing I can see that even comes close is what we see in the New Testament of the heavenly Jerusalem in this heavenly kingdom. So, I don't know if that answers your question, Charles, but that's the idea. Yeah, you're right. That's true. There are other, two of these haven't even yet appeared. Okay, let's pray. I'll let you go. Read ahead. Think on these things. And I have a, over here in front of Janet, there's a stack of my notes. Now, these are my sermon notes. This is what I use when I teach this. I'm just giving you, you're not going to find, this is not real. Most of what I give you is, you know, off the top of my head. But this is the roadmap. And what I'm giving you this for is to let you have something to go back and look over. It's just to sort of remind you of the high points that we've talked about tonight to refresh your memory for us to look ahead to next week. So we'll do that each time. Okay, let's pray. Father, we ask that you would keep our attention focused on what matters the most here, and it's not what happened in 520 B.C. It's the significance of this to us in our day, this New Testament day, and help us to employ the greater light of the New Testament age to understand these dark prophecies in the Old Testament. Help us to understand that what the prophets, as Jesus himself taught us, spoke of him. They're pointing us to him, to a greater day, a day in which we now live, that we might take seriously and be appreciative of the blessings that have come to us, that our God has indeed returned to us in the person of his Son, Jesus Christ. So help us to rejoice in that. Thank you for the time, and sharpen our thinking. Help us and guide our thoughts as we go through this study. Equip us to be better servants, to be able to understand your word and to be comforted by it. In the name of Jesus, I pray. Amen.